Feel Live, made in Sheffield, made by you.
Do you want to get your message heard? With low advertising rates and great sponsorship opportunities, Sheffield Live can help you reach thousands of local people. Get your campaign on Sheffield Live. To find out more about advertising on Sheffield Live, write to advertising@sheffieldlive.org or call 0114 281 4082.
Hello, good evening. Here we are again, Sheffield Live. Live on a Wednesday night in Sheffield Studios here. It's Deserted Island Dis. So Deserted Island Dis is the show where originally we get people from Ireland who are now living in South Yorkshire come and talk to us for an hour, and they pick some songs that punctuate their life. Tonight we've got the most Irish man I know that wasn't born in Ireland. He's a good friend of mine. I've known Kevin Kennedy for must be 15, 20 years sometimes. So I'm really pleased he's come on the show. So, hello, Kevin. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thanks, Ben. Lovely to be here with you on Sheffield Live.
Yes. Sheffield Live, live. Yes, yes. Thanks for being here, Kevin. I mean, you've been a supporter of the show from the beginning, and we've got rid of all the proper Irish first generation people. So it's great that you're next in line. So we're going to have an hour spent talking about your life. It's nice to talk about yourself for an hour.
And it's cheaper than therapy.
Yeah. And then you've picked some songs for us to get through, so we'll get through as many of them as we can as well. But to start with, yeah, so, well, what we like to do actually with Kevin is kind of jump to the end just to give people an idea of who we're talking to. So I don't know if you can, do you want me to try and sum you up or you to sum you up?
You know what, you can sum me up and then I can red pen it, give you some pointers.
Well, what I know of Kevin, he's a wonderful, happy man to start with. Let's say that. No one can disagree with that. A big part of the Sheffield community, a big part of the Sheffield Irish community. But you have successful day jobs of being involved in marketing and promotions and heavily involved in politics, socialist politics, as it says to say.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And much more than that besides, and we'll find out more on that. But you're a lovely man, and I'm very pleased you're on the show.
Thanks for having us. Pleasure to be here.
So what we do is try and get to understand your life and where you've gone from. So I was saying really that I've known you a long time, but your actual kind of beginnings, I'm still not sure about. So tell us about it here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess probably, you know, sort of like a lot of people who've got some degree of Irish heritage to them or anything like that, it's not necessarily the most linear story. I guess sort of most succinctly, I was born in Atlanta. I moved to England when I was about sort of four, and I grew up over here. My family on my sort of different sides, my mum's side of the family is, you know, English as English comes, you know, from rural Norfolk, and you know, my grandparents, you know, died in the village they were born in, and
okay.
I think that's probably the same for 600 generations before them, right? On my mother's side of the family, so my dad's parents were Irish and Polish. They, you know, fled those countries for various reasons. People kind of fled them, you know, murder, fear, famine. My grand's father had been conscripted into the Russian Red Army from occupied Poland and went to America, and you know, they met over there.
Yeah.
And so my dad was born in America. And then he was in the US Air Force. He was stationed down in sort of some of the various US military bases they've got over sort of like the Norfolk-Suffolk border, like Lincoln, Milton.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So there he met my darling mother.
So he picked up a local girl.
Yeah, exactly. In what is now a fried chicken shop. I don't know what it was back then.
Okay, yeah.
So they had me, they moved to America, and I was born. My mum sort of had some sort of pretty severe sort of like health issues, schizophrenic. So just after I was born, she came back to England for the NHS.
Yeah.
So I stayed out with my dad for a few years over in Georgia, and then he got shipped off to Kuwait in the first Gulf War.
Okay.
So I got sent as a little baby on a flight with, well, you get Happy Meal on a flight.
Right.
That's my only real...
You can remember that?
That's the only real thing I remember. I remember there was a Happy Meal on the flight.
Yeah. To where? To
Norfolk.
To Norfolk, yeah.
Yeah, so going from... I mean, I was only about four, but going from, you know, a huge sort of diverse, kind of like very, like, very black city to...
So in Atlanta, Georgia's, yes. So yes.
Yeah.
South and yeah.
To, you know, sort of probably the most monocultural place I've ever been in my life.
Rural North.
Little yeah. village of 600 people. Yeah.
Wow.
That was pretty wild. And then, so I grew up down there. I came to Sheffield for university.
Oh, God, you're jumping ahead too quick. You've missed out loads. Hold on, let's go back a bit. So the Irishness, as you said, is from your dad's
mum. My dad's side. So Grandpa Richard.
So your dad's dad was...
He's a Cork man.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, it's a bit interesting because with the Irishness, it's something that I kind of found a little bit later in life.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I grew up without my dad. So the last time I saw him... He came over on my 5th birthday.
Right.
And then we maybe kind of spoke like a smattering of times, like between then and when I was 18 when he passed away.
Right. Okay. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like a lot of people, I mean, one, sort of the old Irish disease, you know, he drank himself to death in the end. But, you know, like a lot of people, he kind of came out of the military, struggled to readjust back into civilian life. And, you know, he'd passed away within a few years of it.
Yeah. What was his role in the military? What was he doing?
He was a team sergeant in the US Air Force.
In the Air Force, right.
Various things, but sort of like towards the end, working a lot of kitchens on like military bases out in like Iraq and Kuwait and things like that.
Yeah.
He was in both the Gulf Wars, unfortunately for him. So it was actually, so kind of growing up, that entire side of my family was very much... just not a factor of my life whatsoever, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was after my dad passed away that they reached out to me to... I think my aunt had to, like, pulled some strings and found me through Interpol or something
Bit dodgy, but
entirely. It just implicated her.
So what's your mum's views of your dad? Is she not keen?
No, they were always fairly amicable, I think. It was, you know, various sort of like geographies and, you know, wanting to be in different countries and things like that I think sort of drove them apart more than anything else. But, so it was after my dad passed away that I sort of went out to America for the first time since leaving as a kid. And I met this entire side of the family that I had no idea existed, you know, aunts, uncles, cousins and everything. And that was sort of kind of what began, I don't know, like the... transition to Irishness. Obviously, it was never really a part of my life.
So they were like doing all
the
Irish.
They're all very proud, you know, Irish Americans. with, you know, all of the cliches and stereotypes and cringe inducing, you know, Cade Mealy-Fultzs over the door in the house.
The kind of wrong with that territory.
I'm slagging off your kitchen now.
Where was that in America? Sorry, is that in Atlanta still? Or?
This summer, my family's kind of split between, so they all sort of originated from sort of up in Buffalo, upstate New York, near Niagara Falls, and then I had some family out in Colorado, then, some additional family down in Atlanta. So it was great, it was great, I'd lost my dad, but as a 19-year-old,
exciting.
I'd taken a year out before starting university, and, you know, I came back, I'd done a bit of travelling in the South Pacific, and I came back and around the time that my dad passed away, and maybe sort of like the big sadness there was that I had 7 or 8 months before starting university, and I was like, oh, I might actually go to America and go see my dad for the first time since I was 5. And within a couple of weeks of coming back, like, I got the call that he'd passed away. There was a sort of a sad kind of poetic irony to that.
Yeah, because you were at that age where you could make your own choices.
Absolutely, I went over to the States and I spent about 2 months sort of travelling between meeting all the different sort of families and everything like that.
And obviously you're welcomed by all of them.
With open arms, you know, so much love and affection for a person that, you know, if they'd ever met me, it would have been when I was like, you know, a tiny little nugget of a person. It was amazing. And I don't think it really sort of, the magnitude of that really sort of dawned on me until I remember I was on the flight to New York and I'm chatting next to this old couple who sat next to me and they're like, so you're going to America? I was like, yeah, on your own. Yeah. For 2 months. Yeah. And you're staying with people that you've never met before. I was like, yeah. They're like, is that not a bit? And I was like, it wasn't until you, until you just pointed that out now.
Yeah.
That kind of, you know, opened up a whole sort of half of my identity, really.
Yeah.
That, you know, I guess he sort of began, like, you know, exploring into sort of some of the heritage and becoming interested in sort of, you know, more like Irish music, Irish culture, Irish sports.
And politics.
Politics, history.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, we better play a song. Do you remember your first choice? And do you want to introduce it and tell her why you picked it?
So, yeah, serendipitously, I guess sort of talking about my dead father. This is a song by Warren Zevon, which is one of the last songs that he wrote before he passed away of cancer. And I think the first time I heard this was sort of very soon after my dad had passed away. And I remember just one of those moments that kind of a song can kind of just absolutely stop you in your tracks and kind of bring you to tears. And so, yeah, I figured we'd start off with a nice, light-hearted song about,
one,
yeah,
cheerful one about
my dead dad.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go for that. Keep me in your heart. Warren Zevon.
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 Shadows are falling and I'm running out of breath. Keep me in your heart for a while. If I leave you, it doesn't mean I love you any less. Keep me in your heart for a while. When you get up in the morning and you see that crazy sun, keep me in your heart for a while. There's a train leaving nightly called when all is said and done. Keep me in your heart for a while. Shine. Sometimes when you're doing simple things around the house, maybe you'll think of me and smile. You know I'm tied to you like the buttons on your blouse. Keep me in your heart for a while. Hold me in your thoughts. Take me to your dreams. Touch me as I'm falling. Headed north to Pleasant Stream. Keep me in your heart for a while. These wheels keep turning, but they're running out of steam. Keep me in your heart for a while. Sha-la.
Keep Me In Your Heart by Warren Zevon. I've said it right still.
Zevon.
I still got it
so
wrong.
So close. Yeah.
No. He's obviously new to me, old Warren. I've not heard him before. Yes, is he American?
Yeah, one of the, you know, sort of great 20th century American sort of singer-songwriters.
It's
one of the sort of deep cuts, you know. Yeah. I think he's the kind of songwriter that songwriters say they really like.
I'll find out more. I'll have a listen. He's on me in there now, in the playlist. So, yeah, we've got Kevin Kennedy, who's my guest tonight on Deserted Island Discs. I mean, we've been jumping about a bit, really, but we skipped your life in Norfolk then. So you arrived there when you're about 4 years old, you say? Yeah,
absolutely. So, yeah, came there, you know, with nothing other than the happy meal from the plane. And, you know, a heart, like, with great expectations for what it's going to be like in the new world. Like, but I was brought
up. Who did you fly with then? Do you know? Can you remember?
Now you're asking. It might have been a military flight or something.
Yeah,
okay. Like
yeah, into, but I mean, did you have like your dad with you or did,
no. Solo.
Solo. Wow. Yeah. So you just like.
I remember I got. I mean, this is all pre 9/11, isn't it? Where airports were a bit more lax. Yeah. But yeah.
Well, not long ago. We should have said actually, because you're a young man compared to the average age of my usual guests, Kevin.
So I'm 35 years young.
35. Yeah. So So I'm going to try and work this out. So you're born in 1991?
1990, yeah.
1998,
so you'd be... Big 3-6 this year.
Yeah.
It's all downhill after 33, is what I found.
It's the
Jesus year. From that's when you start making sounds, when you sit down and stand up. You know, the worst injury I've ever had in my life was, not like the most severe injury, but the most pathetic injury I've ever had was I was reaching for a tin of tomatoes from the cupboard. Like, did something to my rotator cuff that took like 2 months to lay.
Wow.
But yeah, this is what everyone. If on the off chance there's anyone under 33 listening to this, that's what you've got to look forward to.
You could be right, but you gain so much in other ways with age and wiseness and maturity.
Yeah, and to I guess sort of, you know, thread that through to the kind of topic of conversation there. So. When I came to England, I mentioned before, my mum was sort of really ill when I was a kid, so she didn't really bring me up for the most part. A couple of like times where I did live with her and things like that, but for the most part, it was living with my grandparents. And you know, they gave me sort of, you know, like a happy, healthy home to live in, and I think I really benefited from you know, having that sort of, I don't know, wisdom, and also the sort of unlimited. Time, and not necessarily unlimited energy, but in a way that which, you know, maybe like working parents didn't. So, you know, if I was ever ill from school, there was never a question. You know, there were always, there's always someone to look after you.
So then retired,
My grandfather would always be the one to, you know, like take us to parties and things like that as we got like a little bit older and things like that. Buy us beer from the corner shop. Like,
oh, good man.
That's where it all started,
Well, and you saying it was a little village, really, that you were there. So you'd have was there a school in that village?
There was a primary school in the village, So I think there's about 100 kids in my primary school. And I still remember in sort of my first, like when I first started there, I kind of got mercilessly bullied for obviously having an American accent because this is rural Norfolk and, you know, nothing.
The strangest thing to happen for a long time.
That was probably the strangest thing that happened up until, you know, jumping forward 20 years when I brought my mixed race wife into the village pub for the first time. They probably still talk about to this day. That's why I'm voting Reform. There was a primary school in the village and I was getting horrifically bullied for having an American accent, and a guy who's still, he's my best friend to this day actually, he's been staying up with me in Sheffield recently. He stood up for me, a guy called Miles Hunt, and we've been friends ever since for the last sort of 32 years.
Oh, nice.
All the way through.
So after primary school, did you have to go far for secondary school?
Sort of about 5 or 6 miles down the road.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
School bus, was it?
School bus, yeah. You know, listening to all the hits of the day.
And that is still obviously kind of similar, though, very white. Secondary school.
Oh, God, yeah. I think I was in year 11 by the time a non-white person.
Right.
By the time a black girl joined my year in year 11, and that was the first. It was a real anathema. I mean, but I guess by that point I'd sort of become so kind of accustomed to it because, you know, I can't exactly say that, you know, the ages of 0 to 4 in Atlanta were... overly formative, it really inspired my opinions on racial justice going forward.
But I mean, I might be jumping ahead a bit, but just because kind of knowing you now, and I know how much you're heavily involved in the politics, as you said, and particularly kind of left-wing politics, where did that come from? Was that anything from you grandparents and parents?
No, I mean, my grandparents were sort of probably more on the kind of conservative side.
Yeah. Most people, I imagine most people are around there.
Oh, yeah, you know, it's a very big sort of, you know, wind turbines kill birds. And yeah. Like, it was UKIP back in the day. Obviously, it's, you know, various other ones now. But I think it really the sort of thing that was the catalyst for me getting into politics was the 2003 Iraq War.
Right.
And it originally kind of just came out of, you know, a very, I don't know if selfish is the right way to put it, but a sort of self-interested thing. That I was like, I don't want my dad in the Air Force to go to Iraq and die.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, at 13, I started kind of getting involved in sort of like anti-war groups and things like that.
Yeah,
you'd like, have to go. No, I remember going to the, was it the May the 3rd demonstration in 2003 or whatever in London?
Where yeah, the big one.
A couple of million people.
At
13, taking the train down on my own and lying to school, lying to my to my family about like where I was going.
Yeah. Wow, well done.
But so that was kind of that was the big sort of initial catalyst.
But it sounds so it came from within, from yourself, really. Then
absolutely, and I think probably from then kind of getting involved in sort of
in
like
those groups. Yeah, you would speak to people,
you meet sort of other
the Socialist Workers Party got you, and kind of
they never collared me, but I did have I was very fortunate. I think a lot of people are, you know, that we kind of look back to the people that sort of raised and taught us throughout various points. At a history teacher in high school who, you know, also gave me sort of a love and appreciation of history, but also, you know, heavily imbued a lot of left-wing politics in me as well. Like,
yeah.
I think the kind of thing that, you know, like the...
Yeah, they want to stop now. They want to ban that, don't
they? Yeah, all these woke teachers indoctrinating our kids. And then I was one of those indoctrinated kids.
We better play a song again. I just love chatting, to be honest. But unfortunately, we have to play some songs, Kevin. So you've picked Paul Brady next.
Yeah.
I suppose this goes back to you kind of discovering Irishness, does it?
Or? Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, once I started kind of taking like a greater interest in sort of like my Irish heritage and like, the culture and the music and everything, I think this particularly, I think it was a live version that I'd seen on YouTube, I think, but it was one of the first kind of times when, you know, hearing sort of Irish music beyond the sort of Daniel O'Donnell or, you know, Whack for the Diddle.
Rather than the classics.
You know, sort of seeing like a deeper kind of contextual layer to it. And obviously as well, it's a great immigrant story as well, which I think I probably have some kind of resonance with as well.
Yeah, well, let's play this. So Nothing But the Same Old Story, Paul Brady. Beautiful.
I was just about 19 when I landed on the shore with my eyes big as headlights, like the thousands and thousands that came before. I was gonna be something. I smiled at the man scrutinizing my face as I walked down off of the gangway. But a murderer. Yeah, in their eyes, we nothing but a bunch of murderers. Attack!
raccontan tutte le stesse storie. E saltan tutte le stesse storie.
Paul Brady, Nothing But The Same Old Story, that's it. I've not heard that track either. It's great, this show, for me. I learn loads of music. I thought I knew a lot about music, but every week someone comes on with songs I've never heard before. I know Paul Brady, but I've not heard that track. Fantastic. Thank you, Kevin. The choice of my guest this evening on Deserted Island is Kevin Kennedy. Kevin Kennedy, Ryan the Second. What's all up?
So my legal name, if you want to get into the nuts and bolts of it here. Yeah. Funny, answering loads of questions for people that drink in the graves here. So my name is Kevin Ryan.
Yeah.
Kennedy's my middle name, and obviously the second named after my dad.
Okay.
So after he passed away when I was 18, I started using the full thing.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Why not?
I don't know. Makes it distinctive or something like that.
There's only one.
Strong brand identity, yeah. There's just me, and there's another Kevin Kennedy Ryan, some guy from...
Not the second, though.
No, but some guy from Boston. I think he died of an overdose. So,
okay.
Found that from Googling myself, obviously. Right.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, rest
in peace, Gavin. Yeah. Right, we'll try and... there's lots of laughter, isn't there, amongst the pathos of people dying of overdoses, Kevin. So we're halfway through the show. We've not got you to Sheffield. I've learned something there just in the break about you. So earlier on, if people didn't join us at the beginning, Kevin's... found his dad's family who were in America and did not see him till he was 18, and he went across to America and spent 4 months there. But I suppose you'd done sixth form in Norfolk, rural Norfolk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Done okay. Obviously got good enough grades to...
Absolutely. I probably couldn't tell you what they are now. But yeah. I studied sort of history, English, politics...
So you applied to go to university age 17, as everyone does.
So I knew not very much about Sheffield. And I'd been told that the North is a really good night out. I had a very insulated sort of life, in Norfolk. Never really, and I think as well, like living with grandparents, we didn't travel around, maybe go on holidays and stuff as much as maybe some of the families did. But yeah, I got told the North's a good night out. So sort of Sheffield, Manchester and Leeds were my top three. And I think Sheffield was the only one that did the dual of history and politics that I wanted to study.
Yeah.
So, and I took the day off sixth form to come and, do the open day. Didn't make it past the Wetherspoons next to Norwich train station.
Okay. In Norwich?
Oh, yeah.
So you didn't leave Norwich?
Didn't leave Norwich, no. I just came home 8 hours later, incredibly inebriated, and lying to my family that I'd been drinking on the train back.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, yeah, it's really good up there. Like, and then I got here and I was like, the hills. Yeah. Like, they got every direction.
Not like down. Norfolk, is it?
Nah, it's pretty flat over there. Yeah. I applied. I ended up taking a year out before going off to university. Did a little bit of a stint sort of on a Channel 4 reality show in the South Pacific. So lived on a desert island for 2 months. So that was fun.
Wow. So it was called Shipwrecked.
It's called Shipwrecked.
So
yeah.
I don't know if you've told me that before or not, but yeah, I was like, wow, that's a massive thing to do. How did that come about? Did you just write in a reply?
So I saw there was an advert on Facebook. Yeah. There was obviously, we're talking the really nascent days of Facebook back then, where the adverts were on the right hand side of the page.
So we were talking about 2003 ish, around then?
We filmed in 2008. It aired
2008, sorry, yeah. My maths.
Yeah. So yeah, there was an advert that said, do you want to be on Shipwrecked? I filled it out. I was like, yeah, because that's classic sort of Sunday morning hangover television,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, you've been drinking cans in a field the night before, and then you can sort of just escape and look at all these beautiful people on a sunny beach somewhere. And then I got an email.
Was it like series two then? You were ours. Were you the first ones on?
Mine was probably sort of like the fifth or sixth season.
So you'd seen it before, basically. You knew what it was. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was like, that looks fun.
Yeah.
And I guess you had two forms of people that applied to it, right? You had the people who wanted the sort of Bear Grylls survival element to it, build your own shelter, catch a fish and everything. And then you had the ones that wanted to be the next Jade Goody
So
obviously that makes loads of like internal tensions and things like that as well, isn't it?
But did you have, anyway, I don't know if we could spend all night talking about this, can we? But there must have been like the process of getting in, was that difficult? You had to fight off, you were chosen amongst
one of 150,000 people.
Yeah, I was going to say, there must be like,
and I think sort of towards the end of it, you know, I think once I started, I was going down to London pretty much every weekend for different interviews and psychological assessments I remember coming down for the last one and they just gave me a big 80 litre rucksack. I'm like, there you go. I was like, oh, cool. They're like, we'll let you know when your flight is. I was like, all right, cool. So yeah, deferred university for a year to go and do that. And so it was after I kind of came back from that my dad passed away and I went to America and sort of met all the family over there. And then before finally coming to Sheffield in 2009, and yeah, like I said, being absolutely gobsmacked by the hills.
Yeah.
But I think the city's been brilliant to me. Like I've had so much, you know, I've had so much love, warmth and affection from sort of the people here. And I think that's the thing that really makes the city. And the cost of living's relatively good here compared to other places. You know, when I speak to pals in London that spend a grand for, you know, a room in a house with four other strangers and like that's miserable. You can live with slightly more dignity up here, I think.
Yeah. Well, you've not left, have you, since then? I mean, not for any length of time, or
at university, I met my now beautiful wife. We married for
Jess.
We married for about 13 years now. And she's a Chicago native. Yeah. Again, a little bit like most Americans, really, but a little bit of Irishness in there. Her granny's from Wicklow.
Right, okay.
We met.
She could come on the show. She's qualified.
There you go. Get her in. She was from Chicago. We met. We lived here for a little while. And I think, you know, we're sort of 24-ish, getting itchy feet, being like, oh, let's go do something.
Yeah.
I think at one point we were like, oh, we can go to Jordan or Malaysia or something. In the end, we decided we were going to go back to the States for a little bit. We moved over and we spent about a year in Chicago and, you know, some amazing things happened. We got married out there, which was, you know, absolutely beautiful. I met loads of incredible people, got to know her family, like, you know, in a much sort of like deeper way, sort of living with them. But, you know, I really struggled sort of being away from home. Cause I mean, at this point, sort of my grandfather had passed away, who brought me up. And my grandmother was sort of in like the later stages of dementia. Yeah. And we'd put off sort of the move for a couple of years because my grandmother was still around.
Yeah.
And in the end, we just said, you know, she might live to be 100.
Yeah.
And within about 3 weeks of moving over there, she then passed away.
Wow.
So I was back and forth quite a bit originally. And then I felt, you know, like sort of a tremendous amount of guilt and everything like that for sort of being away when it did happen as well. And you know, sort of like mental health is something I've struggled with like most of my life, sort of really since I was a teenager. But that was a, you know, probably other than maybe about a period when I was sort of around 18, where like I remember both my grandparents were in hospital at the same time, and it was quite grim. You know, without dragging the subject down too much.
No, it's fine.
Yeah, sort of found myself.
I mean, it must be a really tough time because you're still young. You're still in your 20s, and the people that you brought you up had both passed away, and you're far away from home, and not got friends and people around. It must have been a tremendously difficult time for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And then just plus the Chicago winter is brutal, right?
I believe so.
It went from t-shirt weather to -30 like in a week.
Yeah.
We never originally were going to live in Chicago either. We were originally going to go to San Francisco.
Right.
But then we sort of shipped all our stuff to her parents' house in Chicago and said, we'll just rent a U-Haul, drive across the country. And
yeah, nice.
I think after a few weeks sort of being back in the home city, she kind of got a bit of a flavour for it. It was like, I kind of want to stay here. So we spent about a year out there. And then we've been back in Sheffield for about 10 years now.
Yeah, yeah.
Lived around, but I mean, sort of.
Kelham Island, you weren't here for a bit?
Hmm?
In Kelham Island.
We were sort of nearly neighbours at one point. It's been wonderful, really. Met some incredible people, obviously. Sort of how we know each other through sort of the grapes.
We'll talk about that next a bit. I think we better do another song. So it links a bit to what we're talking about. So you've got Wild Flowers.
This is my first dance with my beautiful wife.
So it's Wild Flowers, Tom Petty. Let's play this. Wildflowers, Tom Petty. So that was your wedding song. You got a little bit of stuff. You got famous for your wedding as well, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In addition to being on sort of Sheffield Live Radio, which is the big break, obviously. It's a hard one to tell of the radio, right? Because it's more of a visual.
A visual,
sort of thing.
Yes.
the sort of like nuts and bolts of it is, as you know, sort of closed my eyes, leaning into like the first kiss after the, you know, I now pronounce you husband and wife.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, leaning in, you know, and I think and those, it's one of those moments, isn't it, where kind of time slows down a little bit. And
I don't know.
You never married?
No, no.
just a serial philanderer.
Like, whoa, whoa, whoa,
oh,
come
sorry.
On.
but yeah, so leaned in for the kiss and just heard a big whack. And it took a kind of moment to kind of twig what had happened. My little sister passed out.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, fortuitously, like, she was absolutely fine. The only thing that was sort of slightly bruised was her ego.
Yeah. But more fortuitously.
Yeah. My photographer managed to capture the moment pretty much perfectly. And then I posted it online one night, like, not thinking really anything of it, and went to bed. And I woke up the next morning and my phone's just like, over and over again. Like 6 a.m. Chicago time as well. By this point, it's someone's posted it on, picked it up, posted it on Reddit. It's gone massively viral. The Daily Mail's picked it up, run with it. And yeah, for
is that where you're called Dapper and Handsome?
That is, yeah. They just got me Dapper and Handsome. That's in my LinkedIn bio.
Yeah.
Like,
I know, yeah. Well, why wouldn't you?
Yeah. Along with, and you know, sort of other accolades is actually the tweet about my sister passing out was one of the top 30 funniest tweets of the decade, 2010 to 20. According to BuzzFeed.
Well, there you go.
So, yeah,
yeah,
it's a pretty big deal then.
it is. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So, we're talking about Sheffield. So, let's talk about Sheffield. And I suppose one of the reasons you stuck around Sheffield was the community you found. So, you'd obviously been a student, and you were quite involved with like student union stuff, and you'd got people around. But I remember you turning up as a young lad in the Grapes and singing songs on was it Tuesday night?
Monday night, John Downing sessions.
But didn't you do the Tuesday as well with Ray? Anyway, Monday and Tuesday, yeah, you were there.
Occasionally
anyway.
Thursday with Reg
Yeah. So you kind of found yourself in that, that community of the Grapes fairly quickly.
Yeah, I think so. Because, I mean, it was an interesting time for, I guess, sort of like the Irish community in Sheffield. Because I came in 2009, which was around the time that the Alexandra, the old Irish centre, kind of closed down.
For, yeah.
I think alleged financial impropriety.
A few people have said this on the show, and I'll keep distancing myself from it. But
yeah, I'm keen to say alleged. I wasn't part of it.
But it wasn't there that long anyway, really, because I arrived in Sheffield 2001, and I think it was only open for about 3 years or something. But
there was one in Pittsmore.
That was before my time, yeah.
So yeah, I remember, to be fair, I did go to the Alex once. Because someone told me it's a good place to watch Celtic, and I went to watch a Celtic game there.
Yeah,
which is actually also the first time I ever went to the Dog and Partridge back when Anne had it.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone told me I could go there to
watch Celtic.
Celtic.
Yeah,
and, you know.
Are you a Celtic fan then?
Yeah. I think it kind of came part and parcel with my rapid transition into Irishness.
Yeah, yeah.
coming to Sheffield and someone saying, "Oh, you can go watch Celtic and the Dog." I was like, oh, brilliant. Oh, it's the Irish pub. Great. There. Turned up, you know, young 19-year-old lad, fresh face, but couldn't grow a beard.
Did you have your top on?
Got my Celtic top on. Yeah, I'm like, all excited. Walk in, it's absolutely dead.
Yeah.
And go to the bar, and there's a guy working behind the bar. I was like, oh, you got the Celtic game on? He's like, oh, the landlady hates televisions.
All right.
So we've not got a TV. Yeah. But he's like, I've got the game on the radio, if you want. So I sat at the bar, just me and this guy. Listen to the game on the radio.
Fair enough.
But then, yeah, that did, you know, that big, that was one of the first chapter in a long and storied love affair with, you know, sort of Triplet Lane and the Irish Triangle there.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think the Grapes, in the absence of any sort of like formal kind of
Irish centre,
you know, it has become the focal point of it. And you used to love going in for the music sessions there and some of the old boys, you know, some of them you had on the show, some of them sort of sadly aren't with us anymore. But
yeah, no, we were at a funeral yesterday, weren't we, of Robert, who's not Irish, but he was just a very much regular of the Grapes, and he sadly passed away in February. And we had a lovely funeral at St. Mary's Catholic Cathedral there. And it was poignant for me was that my auntie Veronica passed away on Friday, just gone, and I was able to light a candle for Veronica there as well. So love to all my family that might be listening, and auntie Veronica and her family, will be at her funeral in a few weeks' time in Manchester. But yeah, so I mean, we have that I suppose, yeah, it happens a fair bit, but they get a good send off. You, I had to leave early, Kevin, but you gave him a good send off.
We did, yeah. riotously good. You know, I think it's one of those kind of perfect moments of, an Irish wake, isn't it? It's much more of a celebration of life and
yeah.
People. You know, obviously there were tears shed, but you know, there was lots of good spirits, lots of song, and
the singing looked good. I've seen videos of the singing later on, which is great.
And you know, Michael Barrington had written a poem for Robert. You know, it was really touching. It was a send off. He not only would have, I think, cherished but deserved as well, right?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Let's try and get a couple more songs if we can. We're down to less than 15 minutes left. So you've got Days Like This, Van Morrison.
Crack it on.
So is there any reason, should we just play it?
When you said for some songs this was playing in the background, I was like, this is a belter of a song.
Let's have it.
Yeah. When it's not always raining, there'll be days like this. When there's no one complaining, there'll be days like this. Everything falls into place like the flick of a switch. Well, my mama told me there'll be days like this. When you don't need to worry, there'll be days like this. When no one's in a hurry, there'll be days like this. When you don't get betrayed by that old Judas kiss. Oh, my mama told me there'll be days like this. When you don't need an answer, there'll be days like this. When you don't need a chance, there'll be days like this. When all the parts of the puzzle start to look like they fit, then I must remember there'll be days like this. Tricks it. When you don't have no freeloaders out to get their kicks it. Well, that's nobody's business the way that you want to live. I just have to remember there'll be days like this. And no one steps on my dreams, there'll be days like this. When people understand what I mean, there'll be days like this. When you ring out the changes of how everything is, well, my mama told me there'll be days like this. Oh, my mama told me there'll be days like this. Oh, my mama told me there'll be days like this. Oh, my mama told me there'll be days like this. Oh, my mama told me there'll be days like this.
Days like this. We love a bit of Van Morrison. Thanks for picking Van for our show. We've had him a few times, but I don't think we've had that one, so thank you. So we're drawing towards the end. We've got 10 minutes left. A big part of your life has been politics. We've touched on it, but just tell us about kind of what you're up to these days and what that's meant to you over the last few years. Or start whenever you want.
Yeah, absolutely. So Yeah, I guess, sort of like I mentioned, sort of about 13, started getting, becoming sort of politically active and politically aware sort of through the anti-war movement. And then, you know, obviously being a sort of teenager during the 2000s, it was then the global financial crash and, you know, I was a militant teenage anarchist, like trying to smash windows and protest in London and all that kind of stuff. Again, probably lying to my grandparents about where I was.
Yeah, yeah. Was you quite isolated in that, in where you grew up? Was the other people in your school that were of that persuasion?
I'd say it's probably not. It wasn't a left wing bastion.
No, but it was like anyone that would come in with you to these marches or whatever you were doing.
Yeah, there were a couple, probably few and far between. Really. It's probably more when I sort of came to university that I found more of a sort of political tribe. But I think it's too fair, a lot of people sort of my age, particularly sort of friends from school and stuff, I think kind of consciously have just sort of drifted sort of leftwards over the course of their life with, this, I don't know, just sort of life just becomes sort of habitually more expensive with less disposable income and, you know, just generally a little... You know, the nice things to do are a little bit more inaccessible to people than they were sort of 10, 15 years ago.
Did you get involved in student politics, were you?
I did. So, again, sort of being a teenager during the Iraq War and the financial crash, I was then a student at the time when the coalition government came in and they were tripling the tuition fees.
Tuition fees, yeah.
So, yeah, I was involved in that pretty heavily. Was, you know, we occupied a couple of lecture theatres at the university and that was sort of... A big sort of grounding for my politics and sort of meeting people there that, you know, I'm still like in great touch with today and work on campaigns and things. And so I went off, I worked in bars and things like that for a while and then managed to, I'd always done a little bit of graphic design on the side. Sort of going back to being a teenager, making sort of like posters for like anti-war marches or for a mate's band that are playing in the back room
So you've got the history and politics as your degree, which kind of gave you the, I suppose, more understanding in that field, and you'd be with lecturers, I suppose, that are kind of quite political and stuff, but also at that point you were doing designs for posters for that kind of movement stuff.
Absolutely. So yeah, I remember me and a guy's another one of my best mates, we set up a publicity bureau for the occupation, like churning out posters and things like that, like with, you know, this sort of like vague notion that it's sort of like some millenarian May Paris 1968 kind of moment. We're on the cusp of revolution. Obviously it was fairly unsuccessful. But
we've not had a revolution.
I might have missed it.
But well, was the, I don't know, in your period, because there's been, I suppose, periods where Sheffield... How students have been quite political and done sit-ins and stuff and protests about tuition fees and stuff. Was that in your time or was that...
Yeah, so the sort of tuition fee ones would have been around my time, sort of the 2010 era. And I think sort of more recently it's probably been more sort of more kind of Palestinian activism on campus that is taking over. So I ended up actually working at the university for a while. So I went from occupying it to to their working... I worked in the marketing team there for a while, sort of... Mostly sort of around sort of like the commercial side of it, so like cafes and bars and that kind of stuff. And then I left there just before COVID, actually, and was starting a new job on something like March the 20th, 2020. Just as the entire world's about to explode or implode, whichever it did. And so that job didn't kind of really work out all too well.
Yeah. There's not a lot to market, was there?
Pretty much every... there was no business as usual. Right? And, you know, obviously it was a challenging time for the company without even sort of bringing on a new start or whatever. So I started freelancing after that. And I've been sort of fortuitous enough, again, so to hammer that word today, but... I've been lucky enough that over the last sort of 6 years now, I never actually ended up getting a real job afterwards.
So you've been able to make enough living by freelancing.
Every year's been better than the last one. And, you know, I'm fortunate as well. It's funny, isn't it? Because it's like I work on stuff now that, you know, very heavily in sort of politics, like progressive organisations, NGOs, yeah, trade unions. Nice. And all
so
of
it's
that
stuff
kind of
you
stuff.
Care about. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And it's the kind
and
of
that probably
that
shines through, doesn't it? In
5 years ago, I'd have given my left arm to work on this stuff now. And yeah, then, like, I do find myself, you know, I don't know if complacent's the right word, but, you know, frustrated. I wish I could work on something that, I don't know, maybe took less emotional investment, potentially. But I think it's
well, that's
good
probably
to be able
saying,
to do
probably right works and why
about.
You get the work that probably shines through. What you come out with, the end result, is there because your passion's there for that.
Yeah, that I think I'd really struggle selling washing machines. You know? I don't care about washing machines, but you know, I do care about, you know, genocide or, you know, inequality.
Cool. So people, we're coming towards the end. We're going to try and squeeze your last song in, but if people want to find you and book you for or look at your work, where's the best place?
If you want to look at my work, probably Instagram. Everyone always sort of takes the mick a little bit because my website's about 4 words long. It's just a contact form, really.
Yes, I've seen your website.
But yeah, if you Google Kevin Kennedy Ryan, there's only two of us.
There's only two in the world.
And one of the guys is not here anymore. So
yeah,
rest
well,
in peace.
Yes.
And I mean, I guess sort of speaking of people that aren't here anymore, I think it's probably the last song to play out tonight. Mentioned sort of before, you know, sort of how much of a fixture sort of the Grapes and Anne Flynn and the community around the pub's been of sort of my time in Sheffield. And, you know, there are some people who've been a huge impact on my life that aren't around anymore. And I thought it'd be a nice one to sort of remember them as well, with our friend Robert that we said goodbye to yesterday, and for your auntie as well. So
yeah.
Figured we could hand it over to the quintessential Irish voice of Ronnie Drew.
Okay, well, let's do that, and then we'll have a time to say a quick goodbye at the end. So it's The Parting Glass, a great song, and it's Ronnie Drew's version.
Of all the money that ever I had, I spent it in good company. And of all the harm that ever I done, alas, it was to none but me. And all I've done, for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me the parting glass. Good night and joy be with you all. Oh, of all the comrades that ever I had, they are sorry for my going away. And of all the sweethearts that ever I had, they would wish me one more day to stay. But since it falls unto my lot that I should rise and you should not, I gently rise and I softly call. Good night and joy be with you all. Oh, if I had money enough to spend and leisure time to sit a while, there is a fair maid in this town that sorely has my heart beguiled. Her rosy cheeks and ruby lips, I own she has my heart in thrall. Then fill to me the parting glass. Good night and joy be with you all.
Yeah, this is the poet Benjamin Zephaniah coming down your radio wire, and you are listening to Sheffield Live on 93.2 FM, my friend.
Oh, yes. So we had The Parting Glass and Benjamin Zephaniah, who's sadly no longer with us as well, is he? So it's been the choice of Kevin Kennedy, my guest tonight. Well, we've had a wonderful hour. It's gone quick, hasn't it, Kev?
Yeah, it's slightly morose. Death was like a very, very, very frequent.
Well, there's also lots and lots of laughter. Yeah, your laughter's shone through as well, Kevin. So thanks so much. There's no show next week. I've got to do my day job. I've got to do a work thing. So there's no show next week, but we'll be back the week after with a wonderful guest. So thanks, everyone. Thanks, Kevin. And good night. Have a great night.